Welcome everyone to another episode here at the Damage Report. Excited to present a big day of news to you. And we decided we're gonna have a special treat. So you know, like every once in a while, I'll mention that like I'm like technically like writing a book or whatever. I decided as a little bit of inspiration for myself and possibly for you as well, why not get a New York Times best-selling author to join us for an episode? And that's what we have. Joining us as a full co-host for the first time on this program, author of The Black Friend, available now, Frederick Joseph, welcome to the Damage Report.
Going on, man. How's everything?
Great to have you here. Congratulations, by the way.
Deeply appreciated. You know, it was all you, probably. You know, the second I came on the show, I was like, all right, cool. Thanks, John.
Sort of doubt it. I think it hitting the zeitgeist at the exact right time, as well as a ton of big names encouraging people to read it. Probably more important than me, but thank you. I do appreciate that. Excited to cover the news with you. We had you on a couple weeks ago, it feels like, to talk about your book. By the way, for those who might not know about The Black Friend, give people a little rundown of what the book's all about.
Yeah. So the book is basically conversations with activists, celebrities, so on and so forth, about microaggressions and racism in society. You know, I give a lot of firsthand experiences from growing up as to things I dealt with to try to help people understand things that are more nuanced when it comes to racism and not only be shamed, I suppose, about it.
Exactly. You know, and we had, when we talked about the initial reaction to it, and anything that's talking about racism or encouraging people to be a little bit better, a lot of people's knee-jerk reaction is to get defensive about that. We talked about some of the initial reaction. Now that there's been a few more weeks, overall, what is the impression that you're getting from people about this sort of suggestions you're making in the book?
You know, people have been very receptive to the book. I actually spoke to a woman last night and her 11-year-old daughter, white woman, and her daughter was just saying how much she loved the book. She's a young white girl and she's like, I didn't understand a lot of these things. And this is allowing me to have conversations with somebody instead of just reading it in historical context. And that's really what I wanted. But you know, realistically, you know, a lot of people must have bought the book for it to make the Times bestsellers, or Fox News and Candace Owens just bought a bunch of them to burn. Either way, I'm good.
That'll be awesome. Okay, well, excited to have you on. Thank you to everybody who's already watching, regardless of what platform you're on. Please let people know that we're active by hitting the like button, sharing the stream and all of that. And as we go along, if you send us comments or tweets or super chats or anything like that, we'll be responding to those. For just one second before we launch into this, I did want to let you know about just a couple of things. One, if you watch the pre-show, which is every day about 45 minutes before the show on YouTube, we now have YouTube membership on the channel. Previously, that had only been a thing that was on the Young Turks, now available here as well. So if you go to the YouTube channel and check out the join button, it'll let you know what the perks of membership are. So that is an option. If you'd like to engage with that. Also, there is a new limited Twitch series on the TYT network hosted by friend of the show, Jordan Yule. It's called Deep Dive. It's gonna be a Twitch exclusive, and he's gonna be doing deep dives on stories, you know, that maybe we've talked about here on TDR or on TYT, and you know, engaging with the audience. It's gonna be a very casual sort of show. It'll be starting at today at 2:30 PM Eastern time. And actually, it's gonna be today. The next episode will be on the 17th. So that's this Thursday. I'm actually gonna be co-hosting that with Jordan. So me and Jordan hanging on Twitch should be a lot of fun. And there's gonna be about 5 episodes of this. It's a sort of limited run, but should be a lot of fun. And we've got that coming for you very soon. And I can see the Jordan emojis in the Twitch already. There he is. And you know what? On Twitch, he'll be able to swear without getting me in trouble. So that'll be a nice change. Anyway, with that said, Frederick, why don't we jump into this thing?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, yesterday the Electoral College voted, and another time in a long chain of times that Joe Biden has won the presidency. So he has once again won the presidency, this time with the Electoral College voting. And you know, we've got some responses to that. Not everyone is taking this development the same way, but we want to start with the president-elect. So here is Joe Biden in a speech last night about that big vote.
306 electoral votes is the same number of electoral votes that Donald Trump and Vice President Pence received when they won in 2016. Excuse me. At the time, President Trump called his the Electoral College tally a landslide. By his own standards, these numbers represented a clear victory then, and I respectfully suggest they do so now. If anyone didn't know before, they know now. What beats deep in the hearts of the American people is this: democracy. The right to be heard, to have your vote counted, to choose leaders of this nation, to govern ourselves. In America, politicians don't take power. People grant power to them.
Okay, so we're gonna have a little bit more from the president-elect as well. But Frederick, I wanted to give you, first up, what did you think about Joe Biden and the way he is sort of meeting this, one of the last steps towards hopefully this entire thing being settled?
I mean, Joe Biden is in cruise control basically at this point, right? Like, he's not doing anything. Like you said, he's won about 15, 16 times at this point. He's saying the same things over and over. I think that the one thing that I did see after his win most recently was that he was talking about uniting and healing, which I think is interesting, because just 3 weeks ago, before he had officially won, he was saying that these people were the bowels of society. So to so quickly be talking about uniting is pretty interesting.
Yeah, talking about the bowels of society. Yeah, I'd move on from that. I think that was a good call for him to move on from that. But yeah, and he's gonna do that. We're gonna have a little bit more of him talking about unity in just a second. Really fast, I did wanna mention though, because one of the things he said in that video was that America has proven that deep in the beating heart of us or something, I don't know, it sounded like Pete Buttigieg there, that we beat with democracy. And like, yeah, mostly, and it looks like, hey, this democracy that we have is actually going to continue. They're not gonna totally overthrow it. But like, these last 6 weeks have certainly shown that there are a lot of Americans that don't have a particularly deep and abiding attachment or love for democracy. Like, they want results and they'll take it if a democracy will give it to them. You know, when, you know, white people were 98% of the country or whatever, and everyone else is barred from voting, they'll take democracy if that gives them what they want. But as that becomes harder and harder for the GOP, a lot of their voters don't give a damn about democracy or people being able to vote or anything like that. And I hope, like, we're only really seeing that as an issue right now for the Republicans. Maybe there's some alternate future where that's gonna affect the libs too, I don't know. I hope that if that was the case, we wouldn't respond in the same way of sort of like readily accepting some sort of authoritarian solution to our problems. But right now, I like that Biden is trying to like cast the best light on the situation. But going forward, those people who have turned away from democracy, they don't suddenly disappear and they don't suddenly reboot after January 20th. There's gonna be a lot of people out there that are like perfectly fine with some other Republicans sweeping in and taking out democracy in some other form. That's my fear, at least, Frederick.
Yeah, I mean, I share the same fear. And I do know that, you know, it's political strategy right now, what Biden is doing. It makes sense, right? Trying to say the right things. But we also need to have a conversation that we were a breath away from Donald Trump, A, being president again, and B, they legitimately, you know, tried a coup. And there are so many people on board. You know, if you watch what just happened in DC the other day with the Proud Boys and whatnot, they're really leaning into white nationalism. And my fear is that Republicans now, because of Trumpism, they know that white nationalism won't lose them any voters and it might gain them some. You know, so that's my fears right now.
Yeah. And look, he also like, he was sort of, most of the speech was trying to move past Trump, but he did at another point say the flame of democracy was lit in this nation a long time ago, and we now know that nothing, not even a pandemic or an abuse of power, can extinguish that flame. That is sort of, that's a veiled criticism of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was and still is trying to abuse power in a bunch of different forms. But other than that, it was mostly a sort of trying to bring us together sort of thing. So let's turn a little bit to part of that. Biden has for a long time been one of those Democrats who really does believe that we can work with Republicans. He believes that, you know, the fever is going to break after Trump and Republicans are going to come to their senses and want to work with the Democrats. Here's a little bit of that from last night's speech.
4 years ago, when I was a sitting vice president of the United States, it was my responsibility to announce the tally of the Electoral College votes in the joint session of Congress that voted to elect Donald Trump. I did my job. And I'm pleased, but not surprised, by the number of my former Republican colleagues in the Senate who have acknowledged already the results of the Electoral College. I thank them, and I'm convinced we can work together for the good of the nation on many subjects.
Frederick, what do you think about that? Like, you know, what, there some are acknowledging now that he won. Like Mitch McConnell actually said that he had won. It only took him like 6 weeks. Do you think that, you know, we don't yet know what the composition of the Senate is going to look like yet, because we still have to wait for those Georgia runoffs. But what do you think about the prospect of Democrats and Republicans working together once Trump is out?
No, I think realistically, a lot of people have said, well, they didn't work with Obama, right, over his 8 years. But one thing that's different between Obama and Biden is that Obama's a black man and Biden's not, right? So, that's something that we should call out. He's an older white man who has even more centrist views in many ways than Obama, just by the nature of not being black. So, you know, I think it would be interesting to see. I've not seen it in my entire life, frankly. I've never once seen the Republican Party and people that lead it, like Mitch McConnell, like Lindsey Graham, acquiesce or you know, work in bipartisanship. So, yeah, I don't think it's going to happen personally.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the question for me is, if Mitch McConnell is still Senate Majority Leader when Biden comes in, is he going to let Biden confirm a Secretary of Transportation? Like, it's at that level. Like, is he going to do anything with Biden? Like, are they going to reform the immigration system? Like, that just seems to me incomprehensible. It's possible. Maybe they'll find something. But honestly, like, if you're watching this, ask yourself a serious question. What would a piece of legislation have to look like for Mitch McConnell and the Republicans to want to work with Joe Biden? And is that necessarily a piece of legislation that we want to be passed? Honestly, I don't know. We'll see. I've been wrong a lot. I'm more wrong than anyone else in a job like this, and I freely admit that. I hope I'm wrong here, but I know who Mitch McConnell is, and I have a pretty good idea of who Joe Biden is, and so we'll have to see. Now, that said, while Joe Biden in that speech is sort of saying, I can work with the Republicans and all of that, that's not going to stop a lot of Republicans, especially in the media, from claiming that that speech was something that I don't think it was. Here is a Fox News anchor talking about that speech. Take a look at her spin on it.
Joe Biden and his message of unity, not here, slamming President Trump for challenging the results of the election, why the president-elect might be hurting himself by attacking his predecessor. Plus.
Okay. Like, honestly, Joe Biden, I don't think has ever given a divisive speech, at least not if the thing that's being divided is Dems from Republicans. He's given speeches that are divisive from the point of view of a leftist. He's done divisive stuff there, but he is always waiting. Like, he could reach out to the Republicans, have his hand cut off, and he'd just reach the stump farther. Like, he always is trying to unify with them. And yet for Fox News, it's never going to be enough.
I mean, the reality of it that people have to realize is that you have a media outlet based on grifting, right? And right now they're losing most of their base because their main star, Donald Trump, no longer wants people to support them. So now I think what they're doing is they're trying to be divisive so that they can get some of the Trump supporters back, right? Saying, oh, look at the system, look at Biden, they're attacking Trump. So some of those Trump supporters will come back and give viewership to Fox. But realistically, they're blowing smoke. Biden said nothing divisive in that speech. In fact, I thought that he could have been a little bit more divisive and called some things out.
Yeah, I mean, look, divisive can come in a couple different forms, but I would love to see the Democrats act like they won. And I don't just mean acknowledging that they won. I mean, acting like you won by millions of votes, that the country has rejected the other party, that they actually want you to do something. Democrats in victory or in defeat are always like, well, you know, maybe some people like us, but let's not go crazy. Let's not, like, you know, kick up any dust or anything. Like, you won, man, you won, and you keep winning. We won in 2018 a bunch. We got more votes in 2016, like, act like it. But it's not just Fox. Oh, and by the way, I'm not good with faces in media. Was that Martha McCollum? Do you actually know? I believe it was.
I have no clue. No,
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I try not to pay any mind to too many of them, to be honest. That's true.
Let's, for the sake of conversation, let's say that it was Martha McCollum. So I agree that she, and if not, Martha will do this at some point today, is trying to reappeal to those Republicans that have turned against them, in no small part because Donald Trump is doing everything he can every day to turn them against. I think that's, no, I don't think it's Martha McCollum. But anyway, point stands, whatever. I read in an Axios piece that Trump, says someone who was talking to Trump, Trump was talking to someone about some random thing, and he stopped the conversation to bring up that some chucklehead on Newsmax had beaten Martha McCollum in the ratings the day before. Because he hates Martha McCollum now, because she, like, acknowledged that Trump, like, that is a level of pettiness, being concerned about Fox daytime ratings. Like, that you think you're gonna, like, win him back or his fans back just by calling Biden divisive? You're gonna have to do a lot more. It's gonna take you to some dark places to get those people back on your side.
Yeah, I think that by the end of maybe February, Fox News goes complete owned. I think 100%. There is at this point no other way, because people are leaving, right? They're leaving in hordes, and you know, for Fox has to go to a level that even Tucker Carlson would have to be like, you know, which is a rare thing. Mm-hmm. I don't think Tucker Carlson has ever to turned his back on any white supremacy, but
yeah, and but I think that might be Sandra Smith, actually. Anyway, but not important. They're not the only ones who are calling it divisive. Kayleigh McEnany tweeted, Joe Biden should not ever utter the words unprecedented assault on democracy. This was an assault on democracy. And she lists a bunch of the things they're obsessed with. This is a divisive speech. Of course, her tweet was actually considered divisive by Twitter, so it was flagged as such. But yeah, Joe Biden, like, he spent the entire primary, like, trying to affiliate himself in the minds of the voters with Barack Obama as much as possible. And I think he should get ready to experience one bit of Barack Obama's life, which is spending 4 years trying to appeal to Republicans and finding out that they're gonna attack you at every turn. At least this branch of the Republican Party, I don't think they're gonna be buying it anytime soon.
Which I think is a big mistake. He's gonna inherently do that. But like you said, Democrats have to start acting like they won. Right? Like, they won big this election, like they won big in the midterms. But I just don't think that the party is built that way. There's this oh gosh golly thing to the Democratic Party. And, yeah. And sometimes, frankly, it feels as though the Republicans strategically in terms of communication and letting their, even when they lose, they act like they won. Right? You know, we win and we can't act like we won. So, and that's something that I think needs to change immediately, because we're gonna have a hard 4 years with a lot of gaslighting and a lot of false narratives about this election.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's a good point. Why don't we transition to where some of that gaslighting is gonna come from? The chief source of gas these days. After the Electoral College vote, Donald Trump, apparently, he was pretty surprised by the result. This is a guy who really has convinced himself that it's all gonna come up Trumpy eventually. He apparently, according to Axios, held the false hope that Republican controlled state legislatures would replace electors with allies who'd overturn Joe Biden's win, according to two people who'd been talking with Trump. Now, if you are watching this, and especially if you're very online and you've been tracking sort of some of the narratives coming from the right over the past 24 hours or so, what Trump was hoping for there is a little bit different than sort of the thing that's taken over the right-wing media over the last day. Trump was hoping for the actual set of electors to be replaced. He didn't get that. What he did get is these alternate slates of electors that you've probably seen people like Dave Rubin and others tweeting about. These are just random people. That's all it is. But right-wing media is, like, obsessed with these people. They really are convinced that they're now being sent, like, and they're gonna disrupt this thing when it gets to Congress, that like somehow those are going to end up being the real result, or at the very least that the presence of those alternate slates of electors will allow court cases to continue, and maybe the Supreme Court will take it up. It's not impossible, I suppose. This country is insane and insane things happen. That doesn't seem to me to be a thing that's going to happen, but that's where a lot of the sort of hopes for the future are coming from right now. Frederick, I don't know if you were following that at all yesterday about those alternate slates of electors.
Yeah, I was following it. And I think that it only reaffirms how badly and quickly we need this administration going, right? Because what's happening is that every other day there's some new deep conspiracy as to how the election is a fraud, or how they're going to fix said fraud with some other cockamamie thing like this, right? Like, there's like, I've read a bit about it. There's no grounds. This is not going to work. It's not a thing. They're, like you said, they're just a bunch of people. But what they're doing is, again, said with the gaslighting, they are making people further radicalized in this conspiracy about the election. And it's going to get violent. You know, it's going to get very violent before the end of all this, in my personal opinion, because he's doubling down.
Yeah, I've been waiting for that. I hope not. Obviously, there were, you know, multiple stabbings in DC related to the Proud Boys and all that. I do hope not. But Trump is a dangerous guy when he gets desperate, and he's getting more desperate. Every one of those sort of these steps along the way to this thing being finalized, it's less options for him. And that's really the reason I'm interested in this Axios story, is that the people talking to him say that it's not just grift. It is grift. Like, they're raising all this money, you know, along the way, and he's going to have that no matter what. But like, part of him, he apparently has convinced he's actually going to stay president. And it's taking him to extreme places. So I want to turn to how this affects how he interacts with one Republican. So I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit. A second source says that Trump had ranted about how Governor of Arizona Ducey had been close to the late Senator John McCain of Arizona, Trump nemesis, and how Kemp, a governor of Georgia, in Trump's views, owes him his election but gave him nothing in return. In Trump's private telling, Kemp was way down in the polls during his primary race, and Trump was bored one day in 2018, quote, "So I started tweeting an endorsement and his support put Kemp in office," which is like, whether that's true or not, that actually was the thing that helped Kemp that much, it's a really weird way to present to other people your interaction with politics, that you got bored one day, so you endorsed one guy over another. But anyway, that's not the most important thing here. Trump's tweets, I understand, we're sick of them, they're crazy. His retweets, though, frequently are even crazier. And so I want to jump to this last graphic. This is a tweet from Lynn Wood. Lynn Wood is technically a lawyer, and he's been running around the country doing crazy things. And he tweeted, "President Trump is a genuinely good man," which is crazy by itself, but we'll move on. "He does not really like to fire people. I bet he dislikes putting people in jail, especially Republicans. He gave Brian Kemp and Georgia Secretary of State every chance to get it right. They refused. They will soon be going to jail." Donald Trump retweeted the assertion from this madman that the Republican governor and Republican Secretary of State are going to be locked up for not overturning the results of the election. Oh, and by the way, let's just make clear what he's talking about there. Not even overturning the entire result of the election, because again, even if Trump won Georgia, he'd still lose the election. He's implying that they're gonna try to lock up elected Republicans over this thing. And that's not even really big news today, Frederick. The fact that the president is retweeting that madness.
You know what I will say about Trump's time as president? It has pulled back the veil for me on just how little oversight there is on certain things, right? Like, to me, I'm always like, oh yeah, there's somebody tweeting for this politician. There's somebody, that's not Trump. And I'm just like, oh my God, he's really on the toilet right now, tweeting these things out. Right? And the levels of danger that there are to it are, I mean, you can't speak to how dangerous it is. He's the president of the United States retweeting, just like, I can't, right? Like, when in history has something like this ever happened? I don't think that people have wrapped their minds around it, because it's so normalized that Donald Trump just tweets conspiracy theorists, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and I get that there's probably a lot of people who are just watching and are like, maybe they approach it as, yeah, it's crazy, but he's gonna be gone soon. Or people have been beaten down by the sheer crazy every day. And I get it. I get it. This show every morning, we gotta wake up and we gotta deal with it. But we're not out of the woods until Biden is inaugurated. Trump is still technically the president. He just got rid of his attorney general for not being loyal enough. He's firing people left and right. They're executing people. He still has power, including of life and death. And so we need to take it seriously. But man, this is going to some crazy places in the final weeks.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Here's a really sad, tragic story, and unfortunately one that many Americans and their families have had to deal with during this pandemic. But this has to do with an individual who works in the White House. This is Creed Bailey, who heads the White House Security Office, and apparently lost part of his lower right leg, including his foot, and a toe on his left leg during a months-long battle with COVID-19. This was reported by Bloomberg earlier this week. Bailey handles White House credentials and works with the Secret Service. Apparently contracted the coronavirus back in September. He's been hospitalized for 3 months, but is said to be recovering from his illness. Now, as many Americans have had to in the wake of their health emergencies during the pandemic, but for years before it, friends of Creed Bailey's raised more than $35,000 through a GoFundMe campaign to help pay for his rehabilitation and healthcare. But his family says that he still has staggering medical bills from a hospital stay of more than 2 months. Now, beyond this, there's not much more detail. The White House isn't really talking about this case. And even the family, I can't say at this point, is interested in this becoming a big story or this generating, you know, more interest in possibly helping Creed Bailey. I don't know Creed Bailey or his family. It's possible that Creed Bailey, who works in the White House, is to this day still the biggest Trump fan in the world. But I will say that Creed Bailey, having gone through all of this, not just the unimaginable physical issues of spending months in the hospital and worrying about your death and going through all this experience and all that, but now having these massive financial issues after working in a place, the White House, that could have been better protected against coronavirus than possibly any other building on the face of the earth. Constant testing and screening and all of that, and still got it. We don't know exactly how, but it's easy to speculate that it might have been a result of the fact that Donald Trump doesn't care about this thing, has mocked people for wearing masks, doesn't believe that we need to socially distance, has big parties and brings people in and all of that. And so now, for one of the people who showed loyalty to Trump to be affected not just physically, but financially as a result of it, when the billionaire could make all of these things go away in the snap of his fingers, not speaking for Creed Bailey or Creed Bailey's family. It's possible that Creed Bailey hates my guts. You know, I don't know, but it does seem like a massive injustice that could go away. What do you think, Frederick?
You know, I don't know Creed Bailey. I'll just say that all these people are fools. You know, it kind of goes back to the Herman Cain thing, right? Like Herman Cain being, if I'm not mistaken, one of like the first major people to die of COVID who was like involved with Trump. You know, people are not taking it seriously. And Herman Cain ended up the black guy in a horror movie, really, right? Like, I just don't get it at this point. People are now having to go to GoFundMe even more so than they have over the last few years as the greatest health insurer in this country that GoFundMe is. It's pathetic. And people are so, you know, completely inept to see that Donald Trump and the Republicans are the thing that is keeping their family in the hospital and in the financial situations that they're in. I don't get it. Like, frankly, I don't even have much to say on it because I don't understand it.
Yeah, no, I don't either. And look, this is a weird story. I'm acknowledging it up front. This isn't like, again, I have no idea. We're not getting any inside information. I'm sure Trump will never comment on this. The White House doesn't want to seem to talk about it. But I remember when, you know, the first sorts of waves of COVID were going through the White House, we talked about the fact that it's not just going to be Trump aides and Stephen Miller or Rudy Giuliani who are getting it or whatever. Like the people who just have to work in the White House, people who do catering or part of the cleaning staff or the security or the Secret Service and the guards and all of that, they're going to be affected too. And unfortunately, they're probably going to be left in the lurch. They're not going to be helicoptered to Walter Reed. And assuming they survive, they're going to suffer as so many do. Like, we focus on the deaths in the pandemic because they're horrific. And we've now apparently passed more than 300,000. But for every person who dies, there are many more who had COVID, who suffered from it, and have now survived and might have lingering health problems or might have massive, unimaginable medical bills that they have to pay. One would hope that at least the immediate circle around Trump, that he would provide a little bit of help to them. Like, again, he's a billionaire. $35,000 or $100,000 is theoretically nothing. It's like the change between my cushions. But this guy who continued to work in the White House despite it being an unsafe environment showed loyalty to the president and, you know, to the nation. He's doing his job. He's making sure that people get their security clearances if they need them for the White House, is now being left out. And it's like a case study of what we're seeing all over the country. And it's not necessary. Really fast, I did want to give you updated information. We'd like to check in with the state of the pandemic. We now have over 110,000 people who are hospitalized as of yesterday. Almost 1,400 people died or were reported dead just yesterday, almost 200,000 cases. And by the way, Mondays are always the lowest numbers. So this doesn't necessarily portend good things for the rest of this week. In any event, why don't we turn now to another story of the pandemic? Hopefully he will get his help, Creed Bailey. Okay. one of the weirdest stories that I've seen during this pandemic was a story that the New York Post ran with photos talking about the New York City medic who had helped make ends meet with a racy OnlyFans side gig. Now, apparently, as you're gonna find out, this medic did not want to be profiled in this way, certainly didn't want her personal information to be given out. She was just trying to literally survive during this pandemic. And for the New York Post to do this seems like the complete opposite of what journalism is supposed to be about. Now, she is being defended. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez replied to that New York Post tweet saying, "Leave her alone. The actual scandalous headline here is medics in the United States need two jobs to survive." And so, like, this is being made out to be sort of like a scandalous story that's supposed to be fun or something like that. This is a person who is working. Like, these are the, remember, like, we spent the whole last, like, the last year saying that these people are heroes and acknowledging all the risks that they're taking and all of that. To then treat one who is suffering financially in this way, in this sort of callous way, not caring about their privacy, that seems to me to be a very weird way to approach this.
Yeah, I mean, the New York Post hates women. The New York Post hates people living in poverty, so on and so forth. We know this. This is not new, but you know, this is shaming and attacking on a whole nother level, right? To do a story and take her photos and basically throw her to your millions of audience members is actually one of the most disgusting things I've ever seen in quote unquote journalism, right? And AOC's right. you know, the issue will never be people having to do what they have to do to make money. And there's no issue also with sex work. I'm not really sure what's on her OnlyFans, but if it is aligning with sex work, that's perfectly fine as well. You know, the issue here is that, like you said, the people that we've called heroes for the last year, the essential workers, the people who are, she's a healthcare provider, and we're shaming her because we don't pay her enough. We don't give her the resources to survive in a pandemic while she's helping other people. It's disgusting, and it's you know, it's one of the worst things I've seen in a long time, especially from the from anybody.
Exactly, and in reading about this story, I found out I would have assumed, because I'm even at this late age still naive about this country, that if you're working in this sort of field, and especially in a big city like that, that you must get paid well. This requires advanced training, years of schooling, and all of that. But when she originally went in as an emergency medical technician in 2018, she was earning $15 per hour, where the living wage in that city is $18 per hour. She has a ton that she's gonna have to pay back after the tuition. She's now earning a little bit more, but barely more than a living wage, has family medical issues that she has to help repay. And so, like, if we're gonna have a country that is going to put people in this horrible situation where if you try to pursue a career like this that is helping people on a daily basis, you're going to potentially be in a financial hole for the rest of your life. So she takes up effectively a second job to try to make ends meet and is treated this way. Now, I want to read a comment from her. She says, at the end of the day, it doesn't affect how I treat people, talking about her OnlyFans account. What I do in my free time is my business. It has no effect on how I care for my patients. I know when I'm working, I'm a paramedic. I think I'm pretty good at my job. There are plenty of people who are medical professionals who have every right to do what they want with their own bodies. I'm not doing it at work. Healthcare workers aren't making a lot of money, and I'm not the only one trying to make ends meet. And I, like, what a backwards country are. You know what's wrong with having an OnlyFans account? I don't. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. It doesn't, like, we're not, this isn't the 20s. Like, honestly, why are we being held back by people that are gonna try to shame people out of like making extra? She's closed down the account. Like, hopefully she is still going to be able to survive, although God only knows what sort of lingering social issues she's gonna have as a result of this needless attention being paid by the New York Post.
Well, I'm hoping that she finds some way to sue the New York Post. That's number one, because they've effectively impacted her income. Number two, you know, we should just call it what it is. She's a woman of color, she's a woman and a person of color, right? And that's what the New York Post and many outlets do. You know, you'd rather shame people who are on the margins as opposed to call out the systems in place. And, you know, once again, AOC stepped up with her platform is bringing attention to the, you know, the right side of things. This is disgusting.
Yesterday was the first day of voting in the Georgia Senate runoffs. Last night, we actually had our Georgia Get Out the Vote special. Hopefully, everybody was able to watch that. But I did want to give you a little bit of an update on how the race is going. One day in, there are going to be some issues, as we've been talking about for some weeks. Bear in mind that in Cobb County, the state's third largest county, only 5 early voting sites are open compared to 11 just a month ago in the general election. They are planning on opening 2 more, I'm going to assume, based on the negative response to the fact that they cut it by more than a half in just a month. But we also know, by the way, that the first day of early voting saw 168,000 in-person votes. That is up from 136,000 on day one of in-person voting in the general election, which we just finished. Now, a lot of other things have changed too. There was less time for, you know, mail-in ballots and all of that. But if you want a robust turnout in these runoffs, this certainly seems like evidence that people are engaged, Frederick, that they do actually care what happens in these two races.
Yeah, and that's part of the reason why many Republican leaders have been trying to stop mail-in ballots going forward, right? You know, this only helps people be a part of the Democratic process, and it's looking good, in my opinion, from the things that I've seen. You know, it's looking like people are not only engaged, but people are getting out there. So for those of you who don't know about the runoff, it's probably, in my personal opinion, this might be more important in some ways than any other election in recent memory. Because if they can get the Senate, then Biden actually can do some things, and then we can hold him accountable for doing said things. But if not, we're kind of left in a lurch.
Exactly. Yeah, and my fear is that you know, if we don't get control of the Senate, then there's quite a few sort of centrist Democrats that they don't necessarily want to feel a lot of pressure to really get things done, pass hard, difficult legislation. I want to at least put the spotlight on them. If they control the Senate, then they at least, like, there's an expectation that they will accomplish something. I'm really hoping that. Not to mention the other effects, like the ability of Biden to theoretically put people on the Supreme Court or other judges, you know, district and appeals court judges. That would be nice. The ability to actually confirm members of his cabinet would probably be cool. I would go for that. But first, they do have to actually win. Both Warnock and Ossoff have to win. And I want to show you just a little bit of a video. This is the Democratic Party chairwoman for Cobb County, the county we were just talking about her concerns about turnout going into this vote.
So this election is, it's not a continuation of what happened in November. It's a complete reset. It'll have a different character. It'll have lower turnout, most likely. We always see lower turnouts in runoff elections and in special elections. So we are primarily interested in just turning out any Democrat who voted in November. That's our target audience. Expecting that we will have closer to 50% turnout than the 70% turnout we had overall in November.
And so, look, this is sort of the story of every election. It's going to be just trying to maximize your turnout. The question for me is going to be, who is going to experience more drop-off? Bearing in mind that the Georgia election just a month ago was very close, that Biden won, but it was close, well within one percentage point. So the Democrats, who are coming off of a presidential win that really want to take control so they can actually get something done, and you have the Republicans who have been staying very engaged with the election, you know, via claims of voter fraud and all of that. How do you think that's going to shake out? Who do you think really considers there to be more on the line in these two races?
You know, it's funny because I actually think that the Dems are going to take it handedly, because what you've seen from Trump supporters in the Republican Party, they've been telling people not to vote in Georgia because Georgia wasn't able to go towards Trump in the national election or general election. You know, so it's interesting. And I've been seeing actually what I think is very strategic. A lot of Dems have been sharing some of the Trump supporters' tweets and things like that, saying don't vote, don't go out, don't support Republicans. And I think that, you know, it shows a little gumption, if anything. You know, mm-hmm. So I think it bodes well for the Democrats.
Yeah, we'll have to see. I don't know. Like, you know, Trump implying that it doesn't really matter. Sometimes he tells people to vote for them, but sometimes he implies that the whole thing is rigged and it doesn't matter what you do. I could see how they really do care about what he says, but you also, like, you don't want to not vote, right? Like, I mean, sure, you're talking about the fact that it was all stolen from Trump and everything, but I don't know, like, letting the Dems take control, and when you hate the Dems so much, that just seems to be a difficult thing to imagine. Well, we'll have to see. It's possible this will swing things a bunch. It's going to be very interesting to compare the final result here from the overall Biden-Trump numbers earlier. But if you're watching this and you're in Georgia, go vote if you haven't already. Hopefully you already have. But if you are not in Georgia, that doesn't mean that you can't still help to get out the vote. And there's a lot of different ways that you can do that. You can go, there's a lot of great organizations, which I'm sure you can easily find, but you can also go to tyt.com/GA and you can volunteer to help out in a number of different ways, including phoning voters, texting voters, writing letters to voters, going door to door if you live in the area. There's a lot of different ways that you can help make sure that as many people vote as possible. And by the way, I wanted to let you know about one last little bit of a news update before we move on from this election. The Loeffler campaign has had to put out a statement saying the senator had no idea she took a picture with a former KKK leader. So that had sort of gone viral over the past couple of days. She had taken sort of a happy smiling photo with a guy who had led the KKK. Whoops.
That's one of my favorite things from the past few days, because, you know, I obviously, you know, anyone knew that they were gonna, you know, disavow the photo and say that she didn't know, so on and so forth. But she has like this, like if I remember correctly, like a camo America hat in the photo. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh yeah, you like not only knew what you were doing, but you dressed the part.
Exactly, like you did the cosplay that he wants to see for that thing. Exactly. Yeah, no, she's just an embarrassment. This is like the 30th worst thing that she's done. There's a lot worse, the corruption and all of that. But anyway, she's just a disaster. We got to get her out of there. Purdue is terrible too, obviously, but we got to get Loeffler out of there, especially. So civil asset forfeiture, the idea that in a lot of places, in many cases, these police departments can simply seize money or goods worth quite a bit of money from people, even if they end up not having been found guilty of any kind of crime or anything like that. This is a thing that there have been some attempts in the country to fight back against because of the rampant abuse and the huge amount of money and property that has been taken. So back in 2015, New Mexico lawmakers unanimously passed a bill to effectively end the practice. And you know, there were a number of lawsuits and there was press attention that was putting pressure on them and lawmakers in other states to do this. Now, in the wake of that, there was some opposition to it. What do you know? Coming from sheriffs and prosecutors who were trying to get the governor to veto the legislation. They argued that by eliminating civil forfeiture, this would be a good thing for criminals. You'll get less law enforcement because police departments use the money from that to help fund their budgets. The chair of the state's sheriff's association also said that the end result of this is the cartels are gonna ramp up their money laundering and cash exchanges in the state of New Mexico tenfold, because the narrative was that civil asset forfeiture effectively targets the wealthiest criminal rings and criminal organizations. And then that's one of the ways that you fight back against them is taking their money. The thing is, we now have 5 years of data on this experiment of pre and post ending civil asset forfeiture. And it turns out that a lot of the arguments that were made turned out not to be true. A new study was conducted by the Institute for Justice, is a public interest law firm that's been advocating for reforms to forfeiture laws. They found that there was a predicted rise in crime and drop in arrests, but that they actually have not found that. Arrest and offense rates in New Mexico remained essentially flat before and after the law went into effect. That's based on an overall examination of all crimes, as well as looking specifically at things like drug possession, drug sales, and driving under the influence. Arrest and offense rates were also consistent with trends in two neighboring states, Colorado and Texas. So it turns out that some of the argument that was made before this reform was made and afterward in trying to get it reversed did not actually come to pass. And ending this practice that doesn't necessarily end up in practice targeting these cartels and massive criminal organizations, and a lot of the times ends up just taking a few hundred dollars or $1,000 from regular people, might be a thing that other states might want to look at.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is frankly laughable. You know, when you were reading it and they were arguing that this is also how police, you know, pay for their budget, so on and so forth. That's funny. You know, I think it's absolutely funny because forget the data, whatever, outside of doing 5 years of research, we can see that whatever you've been doing over time has not worked, right? Like nothing has gotten better around the country in terms of police doing their job, or you know, less crime, so on and so forth. And I'm really tired of it. And I also hope that you know the coming administration actually does do work towards. I would personally love to defund the police and abolish police altogether. But I do hope that they actually put in some things in terms of reform, because you know this is just ludicrous at this point, right? Like the idea that you're going to manipulate people with saying that these things in effect are going to help stop cartels, but all you're really doing is hurting, you know, the everyday person who's not a millionaire, a drug lord, billionaire, so on and so forth. It's disgusting.
Yeah, you know, I just want to show one little bit more of information on this. And this was this is numbers that we've shown before. It's from 5 years ago, but back in 2015. The amount of money that was seized by federal law enforcement in civil asset forfeiture was actually higher than the value of everything that burglars stole in the United States. Now, granted, you know, we're talking about, you know, different communities necessarily, but I think that's pretty amazing. Like we're talking about a lot of money there. And that is why I think you get a, you know, a huge pushback from the police. It's not that this is a tool that is particularly useful in taking down criminal rings. I don't think that, maybe they think it is or not. They're apparently wrong based on the data, but whether they think that or not, it is a lot of money, and they definitely don't want to lose access to, you know, millions or potentially billions of dollars across the country. Now, that said, Frederick, thank you so much for joining us on the program and walking us through the morning of news. As we alluded to in the beginning of the show, you've got a book out, apparently doing quite well. Where can people find this?
You know, people can purchase the book anywhere. I suggest that people support local bookshops. So go to bookshop.org and you can find me exactly where the thing says you can find me. So I appreciate you guys having me on. And if I can, I'd like to get a name next time, John. You know, I think that's unfair. I didn't get a name.
Oh, well, so the thing is, generally when guests are on for the first time, I get a little bit of embarrassed and I don't want to overwhelm them with too much of the very particular culture to the show. But I got to remember that you're actually more familiar with the show than most of our first time guests. I can see people in the chat who are quickly coming up with names, including Local Dragon, thanks to your shirt, I think. Multiple people saying Local Dragon.
Okay. So I'm local from that one.
I like that. Wise Dragon, I'm seeing. Okay, well, let's not lock in anything yet. Let's let it percolate in people. Okay. And the next time you're on, maybe we can take that up as one of our tasks for the day. Friendly Local Dragon, that's funny. Anyway, Frederick, thank you so much. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me, everybody.
My expectations for the Supreme Court in virtually every area have never been lower than they are these days. And no matter the topic, I go into the conversation of what the Supreme Court is likely to do with the expectation that we're gonna have no justice. And it turns out, oh my God, in a couple of different areas lately, they haven't done so bad. They didn't pick up the big Texas case, that was a good one. And we're very lucky to be joined on the program now by attorney and author of Staying in the Game, Adrian Lawrence, to break down a second. Adrian, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, much appreciated.
Very glad to have you here. So I actually was made aware of another ruling by your tweets about it. And so tell us about this, this area where the Supreme Court unanimously, when they don't seem to do much unanimously, overturned this military court.
Yes, so the unanimous decisions I think are gonna be coming out a little bit more and more, in part because the court knows that its legitimacy is in question. But in this case, it's United States versus Briggs. And basically what we had was three service members who were trying to get out of their rape convictions on a timing technicality. And they were really relying on a 1977 SCOTUS decision that only applied to civilians. So basically the gist of the case is that you have a military code that applies to the military, and it said that any kind of military offense that's punishable by death could be charged at any time. There's no statute of limitations, because the general statute of limitations, the catch-all, is like 5 years for military offenses. So these three service members were charged and convicted of rape more than 5 years after the rapes. And so what they did is they went to SCOTUS and they said, hey, based on this 1997 or 1977 decision that you issued saying that rape can't be punishable by death, that means that we should not have been charged with these crimes because we were charged more than 5 years after the actual rapes, because in the military, rapes can be punishable by death. And so it's a little convoluted and a little bit difficult to understand, especially like when you don't have a whiteboard in front of you. But basically they were looking to get out on that technicality.
Yeah, it seems like there were sort of multiple loopholes that were being patched in different areas, and you have an act of Congress that's interacting with the military's rules, which are interacting with the prior Supreme Court case. And then that is now, and then the top military court seemed to be willing to go along with that, but has now been overruled. Were you surprised that they ruled this way, that it was unanimous? And how significant is this?
Super surprised, only in part because you bring in the background of these players, where the vast majority of the court is now very conservative. Also, we have two members who've been accused of sexual misconduct, because essentially rape in the military is workplace sexual harassment, which you know, this court knows very well. And so I did not expect this court to be unanimous, 8-0, saying no, essentially, that this 1977 SCOTUS ruling doesn't apply to the military code, only to civilians, which is the larger framework, and also for Alito to write the opinion. You know, and this is huge because in part, it really means that military rapes between 1977 and 2006, because of how the statutes were written and when they were changed, it means that those that were convicted after 5 years after the rape, that they get to stand in terms of those convictions stand. Because the risk was of having these people who had been convicted of these military rapes being let off. And yeah, you know, the court is positioned to where they could have let that happen.
And for context, for people who aren't following, the military rape has long been a thing that the military seems incredibly unwilling to take on as a thing that needs to be stopped, but is also incredibly pervasive, according to survivors.
Correct, absolutely. And the fact that Congress, who really writes and creates this military code, that they had decided that rape could be punishable by death in the military, that is something that SCOTUS pointed out. The fact that Congress didn't change this when they could have changed it, but no, they make it clear. And we're not saying this isn't a capital punishment argument, because I do not believe any of these individuals who came before SCOTUS had been sentenced to death in any way. But you are absolutely right, John. And women make up about 20% of the military, but they're 63% of targets for assault. And studies also show, based on the Department of Defense, their annual report on sexual assault in the military, show that one out of every 16 military women are sexually assaulted, groped, raped in some way, whereas it's one in 100 military men, and this is a problem.
Yeah, wow. A couple quick follow-up questions I have. One is, as we've pointed out several times, it was unanimous 8-0, owing to the fact that Amy Coney Barrett wasn't involved in this decision. Were she to have been, do you think that she would have gone along with the majority in this case?
Yeah, I do. Because I think it was unanimous for a reason. But I know I've been on this show kind of talking about how largely these things that aren't necessarily legal that impact SCOTUS. We saw it with Earl Warren's court, where he got Brown v. Board, Gideon v. Wainwright, these cases that were so and are so seminal to our civil rights. He got those all to be unanimous, and they're so powerful. And so I think Roberts, being the Chief Justice, he knows that his future and his legacy depends on certain cases and how they're ruled upon. And so he is going to lobby, and it's almost the political aspect of the courts. And so I think that in part, this is why this case was ruled to be unanimous, is that he lobbied for it. Because that's, you know, hey, we can't take politics out of everything. And the fact is that if you know it's the right way to go, let's just go that way and do it all together. Yeah. So I do think she would have joined on.
Okay. And, you know, to the general statute of limitations that you mentioned of 5 years for these military crimes, that seems short in comparison to statute of limitations in different areas of civilian law, isn't it?
Yes and no. So the vast majority of statute of limitations, or I shouldn't say the vast, because I haven't done a full like 50 state survey of all the types of crimes, but usually things that are civil related crimes, let's say breach of contract, we're looking at 3 years. Defamation's usually 1 year. So I'd say almost 1 to maybe 5 years max if we're looking at just civilian. Okay. Civil type crimes, but when we're dealing with criminal, they are usually more expansive. And the good thing is that the statutes for the military code, things that involve rape, murder, kidnapping, any kind of assault of a child, those have no statute of limitations. So they're actually broader when it comes to military activity, which is good. Exactly.
Okay. I was wondering about that. Okay. And then finally, sort of looking forward, you've talked about how you consider this to be both important substantively and also that it tells us something about the Supreme Court. We now have a very conservative Supreme Court, more so than we've had for many decades, and we're likely to have it for quite some time. When looking ahead to the possibility of future either sexual harassment, sexual violence related court cases that could make it to the Supreme Court, do you believe that this tells us much about how this court might approach those sorts of questions outside of a military context? Are they going to surprise us by prioritizing justice when it comes to sexual violence and harassment?
I think it depends on the tenor of the nation, because right now we're extremely divided. Also, everything is very disruptive still, and the legitimacy of the court is in question. And so I think until there's some sense of normalcy, where we get back to the status quo of we'll just, you know, let that stuff go. I think that the court is going to be very cognizant of its rulings and how they are perceived, because essentially we're at a point where there could be a revolution tomorrow, and the court is aware of that. And so they realize there's only a certain level of nonsense to which they can get away with. So I think it does keep that sense of conservatism in check. And so we're going to see how things go, because they could pivot back the moment Biden is sworn in. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah. Well, certainly all eyes will be on the SCOTUS for some years to come. Adrian Lawrence, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.